that I left out of the last bit of the previous talk, I think, based on some of the questions I got, I think are important about saving or investing. Just a few principles, I guess. One would be always know how the person who is selling you an investment makes their money. Some make, you know, they want to charge a percentage of your assets to manage. Some are selling you investments they make money off of. I've seen people buy investments, especially certain types of annuity, but they did not realize they really could not get their money back for a long time without massive penalties. That's because a lot of that money went to the guy who sold them the annuity. You know, people who do investment advising have fiduciary responsibility to explain some of these things, but sometimes it's not always made clear. A lot of times people, they have a relative or someone they meet at church. Well, you're an expert, I'm afraid of this. You may not be doing any better with that person. And sometimes they have self-interest in terms of what pays them the best. You need to understand how they make their money. Another general principle is never invest in something you don't understand. Bitcoin, in my opinion, a lot of the cryptocurrencies, to me, seems like you're at a poker table. I think Warren Buffett said he wouldn't give $5 for all the Bitcoin in the world. Maybe because he and I are old. He's a generation older than I am. A lot of people who are wealthy lose a great deal of money by investing in complicated vehicles, sometimes for tax avoidance, and then they just end up losing their money anyway. Third would be, in general, risk and reward go together. There's nothing completely risk-free other than treasure in heaven, but somebody says, I can give you a 15% safe return on your cash. What should you do? Run fast. Actually, I'll tell you one place you can get an 8% safe return on your money right now. The I-bonds. Some people, the Wall Street Journal has written about that. Their government issues savings bonds. You only get $10,000 per person per year. That it's linked to inflation. It's like the one place on the whole market now you can get a fair rate of return on your money, which is inflation plus a little bit, as opposed to putting your money in the bank and you get less than 1%. They tax that, and then your money's worth 10% less or 8% less at the end of the year. So that's one place you can put, you know, some relatively small amount. But in general, if you think you're going to triple your money, you're just as likely to have a third of it left over when it's done. You can't get greatly increased reward without greatly increased risk. So just beware. I'm not against risk. I just think risk needs to be understood, which goes back to the previous principle. I also think there's wisdom to diversification. I'm not saying Ecclesiastes proves this, but it says, sow your seed in the morning and sow it in the afternoon. You don't know which is going to work out or bear fruit. If you put all of your eggs into the basket of the company you have to be working for, and they have trouble, you've got unemployment, plus you've now lost a lot of your value of your investment. So there's wisdom to different kinds of investments. If you're in a position to be able to do that, some of us need to get out of debt first and then worry about the other stuff later. Okay. Last major topic, and I admire you. Most of you stayed awake the last session. I don't blame anybody if you didn't completely succeed. I used to run marathons, and this feels like about mile 24 right now. And then Q&A will be the last 2/10 of a mile or something. So, actually, a little bit like money, that sex is often a reason. Sex does often become a major issue of conflict in marriage. But usually, sex problems are relationship problems. And the marriage relationship is what it should be. Usually this part of marriage works out well. If this is a problem, there may be people who have medical issues or other things going on, but generally speaking, it is related to how the relationship is, and then sex is the expression of it. When I talk about this, I want to be very circumspect, in the sense that sometimes there have been Christian meetings where somebody will get up and talk about sexual issues, and it's almost an R-rated talk. And the Bible does speak frankly about some sexual issues, and I think we can be free to talk at that level. But I think we also have to be somewhat careful. I've been at meetings before where people might have been embarrassed that their young people heard what was said. It was a bit too much. So we need to be circumspect. The title of the talk is From Idol to Blessing. And my belief would be that the real problems sexually relate to making that which God has designed to be a blessing in marriage, when we turn it into an idol in its various ways that is expressed, we have trouble. We already said last night the purposes for sex in marriage. It's the sign of the covenant. It's for having children. But also that God has intended sex to be enjoyable. In Deuteronomy 24, it says a man who was newly married should not go off to war for a year, so he would bring happiness to his wife. The whole Song of Solomon is a description of sensual delights of a husband and wife in married love. You know, the wife says, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. And they both describe each other physically as being very attractive. So sex is not something dirty or evil. It's not the result of the fall. It's part of God's original design. And you know, that's the one part of the culture gets is the pleasure that sex affords, detached from the covenant commitment and detached from children. And then, as we said last night, any sexual expression outside of marriage is sinful. Now I'm going to speak briefly about lust. That there will be controversy. Some of this relates to us as parents, where you have young children, and as they grow into adolescence and teenage years, this is going to be a temptation for them. I'm glad I wasn't a young Christian teenager when there was an internet. Temptation was enough in its own way in that day. But in our day, most of our children will be exposed to porn, some level at a very young age, no matter how much we think we're sheltering them. I think it's good to try to protect them. The greatest protection they need is of their hearts. Because if they want it, they're going to be able to find it sooner or later, no matter how much you think things are locked down. And I could tell you stories of parents that thought they had everything locked down in certain ways and how kids got to the stuff. Along with that comes the temptation to masturbation, to self-gratification. And I think we need to help our children deal with that temptation. Some as adults go on experiencing that. I think the biblical case against that is twofold, multifold, I guess, really. We know in Matthew 5 that Jesus says if you look, think lustfully about someone, you've committed adultery in your heart. So pornography obviously falls into that because you're looking upon someone, reading about something for sexual pleasure. It's not about your own spouse. Therefore, it is by nature adulterous. And in terms of the self-gratification, it really gets down to who owns you and what is your body for. And again, that's the culture is, well, my body is my body. I can do whatever I want to. I can identify whoever I want to. Well, for a believer, 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 20, you have been bought with a price, therefore glorify God with your body. So my body belongs to the Lord. I think it's clear to me this is not what God has designed my body to be doing, especially given what has to go on in my mind, my body to engage in that. Furthermore, 1 Corinthians 7 says in a secondary way, who else does my body belong to? My spouse. 1 Corinthians 7:3, the husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does, and likewise the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. So our sexuality is designed to bring happiness to our spouse inside the marriage covenant. And even if one is not married yet, practicing making oneself happy, using sex to please oneself, is contrary to God designed your sexuality for someone else, not primarily for you. Not to mention the fact you get married, the mystery of entering into the sexual union in marriage being a blessing, but if you've been looking at all kinds of other people and even imagining all kinds of things and even learning how to make yourself feel good, that is all contrary to God's design, where the looking, the experiencing, and the learning is supposed to happen covenant marriage has been made, and it's something wonderful to explore, like Song of Solomon describes. Okay, now what do I do? My kids are struggling with this. There was a famous Christian teacher who said, hey, it's normal, don't worry about it. I'll have a question. Do 5-year-old boys often lie? Yes. Does that mean it's okay? No. Okay. Many teenagers are going to struggle with this. More and more women either are struggling or admitting it. It's like teen, young adult, even into marriage. That does not mean you're not a Christian. It does not mean you're hopeless. It means it's like all the other sins we struggle with. It's something, there needs to be a strategy to fight it and try to put it to death. And that's not the major subject for today. But the aspect, your sexuality, you belong to the Lord. He wants you to belong to your spouse if you're married right now or in the future. And to reserve your sexuality exclusively for them, which means because we all are sinners with sinful desires. We have to fight those desires, just like we have to fight inappropriate anger, anxiety, and other struggles we may have. But it's not like we expect, especially at the heart level, it's always going to be perfect. But we're putting to death those sins rather than cultivating. Which gets to terms of God has given us this gift, and we've ruined it by making it ultimate, making it like an idol. And in Romans 1, when Paul is describing, you know, he's beginning his case that the sinfulness of humanity in verse 18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against the ungodliness and righteousness of men. And he talks about how God's glory is displayed in creation, its power, and people suppress the knowledge of God. I love it at the end of the chapter where he also talks about our conscience, that they know that people who practice sinful things are worthy of judgment. So we, all people deep down know God through creation and through conscience, but it says they suppress that knowledge. And interestingly, the way he mentions specifically that they express it is they professing to be wise, they become fools, they did not honor God as God. And he talks about worshiping the creature, and then he talks about sexual sin. For this reason, God gave them over to degrading passions. Their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural, and so forth. So what Romans is saying is that as people have rejected God's authority, one way their rebellion is expressed is not just making idols of wood and metal and stone, but through rejecting God's design for sexuality and making sexuality ultimate. And this is something really widespread in our culture. I think most of you are familiar. An idol is anything we put in the place of God, that which we worship. Even something good can become an idol when we desire that more than we desire God. The movie Titanic, Rose said of her lover, "He saved me in every way a person could be saved." Tim Keller says, for our culture, sex is a way to be yourself, find yourself, primarily for an individual's fulfillment and self-realization, however he or she wishes to pursue it. And yet, it is enslaving and destructive. And that's, again, the irony where you have, I mean, right now there's a famous trial going on with celebrities and they're in all this weird stuff and hurting each other. You think, well, these people are attractive and rich and successful. Shouldn't they be the happiest people on earth because they're with these incredibly attractive people? But their godlessness, they're just miserable. 2 Peter 2:19, starting in verse 18, actually, "For speaking out arrogant words of vanity, they entice by fleshly desires and by sensuality those who barely escape from the ones who live in error, promising them freedom while they themselves are slaves of corruption. For by what a man is overcome by this, he is enslaved." And so, making sex the ultimate thing is enslaving. It's destructive. But now here's where we will become uncomfortable. You say, well, boy, I'm glad I'm not a gay pride person. I'm not a transgender person. I'm a married man or woman. I must not have this problem. Idolatry, sex can be an issue within marriage. I must have a certain type of relationship, a certain type of thrilling sexual relationship with my spouse. I must have sex a certain frequency, so many times per week or month. I must be able to have sex whenever I want to have sex. My spouse must stay in shape and look a certain way for me to be happy. I've counseled people where a man wanted his wife to have breast enhancement surgery for himself sexually. My answer was, if you weren't looking at a bunch of other breasts, you wouldn't complain about the ones the Lord has given you in your own marriage. I must feel beautiful and attractive in order to want to have sex. My spouse must like this, want it as much as I do. My spouse must do certain things for me sexually and be glad. This is where pornography has been such a horrible influence, because pornography goes beyond the normal intercourse between a husband and a wife. And it's adding things. We've had a woman call us, a newly married woman, saying, my husband wants me to do a certain thing that I find pleasant and painful. And he didn't get that idea from reading Song of Solomon. He was watching garbage where, this is the point, when you make an idol, whatever you had, it keeps more, it's like drugs. You have to keep doing more and more and more different to think you're still getting the buzz you want. I must have a spouse who's romantic, and communicates with me, and woos me and wins me before I'll be willing to be with him or her sexually. Or I must be allowed to sleep when I want to sleep. Every sexual experience has to be 10, perfect and amazing. My spouse must tell me I'm an amazing lover. I must have this kind of hot sex life if life is to be full, because isn't that all that life is about? And that's where most of us, to some degree, have to examine ourselves. We can be obsessed with what we want. It's back to James 4. What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? It's not the source of your desires that wage war in your members. The temptation can be, well, hey, is wanting sex with my spouse, is that so wrong? Well, if you want it so badly, you're willing to sin if you don't get it, or you're willing to sin in order to get it. Yes, it is. And so the man who has tried to be faithful, keep his eyes and his thoughts where they should be, has all the stuff protecting his phone and computer, and he hasn't looked at bad stuff, and he says, boy, I'm a happily married man. I'm going to go home. I'm going to be with my wife. It's all going to be great. Then he walks into the bedroom. She's sound asleep. Do not disturb sign on her back. Doesn't she know I have needs? Doesn't she know what a good man I am, that I've been faithful and stayed away from all this stuff? And she's supposed to be there to help me. 1 Corinthians 7:3, there it is. And he can be tempted to be mad, be angry, or other ways around. So, there's a lot of sadness that comes in when there's idolatry. Bad things happen. One bad thing that would happen is the wife tries, okay, trying. And because it's an idol, and idolatry is never satisfied. I keep trying and nothing I do makes him happy anyway. What's the point? Or if you're looking for the next thing and the bigger thing and the greater thing, that's where turning to pornography or turning to prostitutes or turning to affairs, because again, you have this is your ultimate life. Not the Lord. And so you just keep going for the heavier drug and the bigger buzz. One can just become bitter and give up. Again, it's back to Isaiah 55. The Lord says, come buy and eat without money, without cost. Come buy wine and milk. Our ultimate satisfaction has to be in the Lord. It's just like with money, right? Money can be a good servant. We can enjoy the stuff we buy. But if money becomes your goal in life, you're an adulterer and you'll never be happy. And even sex within marriage can become that as well. C.S. Lewis writes of an ever-increasing craving for an ever-diminishing pleasure. Now, positively, the gospel gives us hope that we can be transformed. Such were some of you. Whoever's in Christ is a new creation. Part of the transformation which should take place in marriage would be to have all of marriage, including this aspect of marriage, transformed into be something which is loving and God glorifying. I'm going to go over the next session very briefly. In your notes, you're probably glad to hear that. But in Proverbs, there's so much wisdom about sexual issues, and it's talking generally to a young man. It also applies to any of us, young woman, older. The longer passages in chapter 5, 6, and 7 give extensive warnings about sexual temptation. I love to go through it as a whole talk sometimes. I'm going to give you the 5 or 10 minute summary. The wisdom Proverbs gives you is to give you an analogy borrowed from Calvin, is God's wisdom enables you to kind of put on your glasses so that you can see the adulteress as she is, and you can see your spouse as she is, and that's going to help keep you out of trouble. Does that make sense? And so Proverbs 2, verses 16 to 19 is like a summary of what's in chapters 5, 6, and 7. It says, wisdom will deliver you from the strange woman, from the adulteress who flatters with her words, that leaves the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God. For her house sinks down to death, and her tracks lead to the dead. None who go to her return again, nor do they reach the paths of life. So, in chapter 7, there's a more detailed description of the adulteress, but it could be the adulterer. And there you go. And the Proverbs doesn't pull any punches. She looks good, she feels good, she smells good, and she gives you good food to eat. She appeals to every one of your senses, but she will destroy you. And what Proverbs is saying is that it's like if you had glasses. And the analogy I would give, like, it'd be like if you looked at the strange woman. It could be the strange woman two-dimensionally that appears on your phone or your laptop. It could be a strange woman in your workplace who is flirtatious and seems to be available to you, or man. And if you put on the glasses, that person who seemed to be so attractive, suddenly they look like some kind of hideous orc out of Lord of the Rings or out of Pirates of the Caribbean, some ooey, gooey, drippy thing that is just, ooh, I don't want that. That's what wisdom does for you. It helps you to see her according to her character and her end. And we need that reality. We need that reality. Again, just whatever level of entertainment you watch, and you have adultery portrayed in a certain way or sexuality portrayed in a certain way. And even if you're watching the PG or PG-13 stuff, they're not showing all the body parts, but they're still showing the morality of the things. You know, the ultimate experience is with somebody you're not married to, doing whatever. So it delivers you. It's the adulteress who flatters with your words. Most of the counseling cases we've had of adultery, especially with women, I think it's largely true with men. It's more flattery than sexuality. Tends to lure people away. Someone who says, you're smart, you're wonderful, you're intelligent, you're the person of my dreams. You go, but it's a flatterer who's spreading a net for your feet. See her as she is. She's a strange woman. She doesn't belong in your life. She's to be outside. She's not a promise keeper. She leaves the companion of her youth. You're not the first. You won't be the last. When she's tired of you, somebody comes along with a better deal, she's off to them. She forgets the covenant of her God. She doesn't fear God. She'd be willing to do this. I'm counseling a case at a distance right now overseas, and part of the reality is to help the woman who's had the affair with the guy she works with. This is not a good man. You know, he doesn't fear God. He doesn't respect his own marriage. He doesn't respect your marriage. He's seduced you. He's tricked you with his flattery. See him for what he is. He's evil. And then her house sinks down to death. This is so vivid. It's like when you cross that threshold, it's like a horror movie. When you step into the haunted house, it sinks down to hell. That, you know, it's going to destroy you. And Proverbs is saying the wisdom of God is like putting on your glasses and you can see sexual temptation of all kinds as reality and their true character and where it's going to lead. And it should make you want to run away. But so Proverbs said, there's this woman who can destroy you, or this man who can destroy you, and as life goes on, it's going to happen. Actually, some of the nonsense people are talking about now is like, well, if a person with power tries to seduce a person who doesn't have power, consent is impossible. Sorry. You're going to have those experiences in life, and you have to honor the Lord and be like Joseph and run when those things happen. And so, you need to see this person quickly as they are. If your glasses are on, it's obvious what they are. But then positively, you could go through the same passage about your wife, okay? Your spouse, your husband. God wants you to see them as they really are. It's the opposite of this woman. This is not the strange woman. This is the woman who belongs. Your wife may not flatter you. She may tell you what you need to hear, but she's the faithful friend who admonishes you. She's been faithful to you as the companion of her. She's kept the covenant she made before God. And through her, there's life, there's children, there's blessing. And so, and then, you know, Proverbs in chapter 5, when he says in verse 15, drink water from your own cistern and fresh water from your own well. Should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the street, let them be yours alone and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. As a loving hind and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love. Why should you, my son, be exhilarated with an adulteress? And so, positively, for those who are married, there is the God wants marriage to be very fulfilling, including sexually. And to bring this joy to one another and to find this joy in one another. So marriage can be a help against these temptations, a good marriage, and it's where that part of the relationship is in its proper place. Bruce Waltke, the Old Testament scholar, is struck by the fact that it says be exhilarated, because normally in Proverbs and the Hebrew, like, we're supposed to be self-controlled. You know, don't drink too much wine. You've got to be under control. It's like, here's one time in life where you can totally let go with your spouse. And that's a great thing in the privacy of your marriage. So a wife can be a great help to you in this area, or a husband. But here's the problem. Some people don't have a husband or a wife. What do you do then? Or you have a spouse, but they're not very helpful. Maybe they're disabled. Maybe they're not godly or helpful. I had a friend. I've had a couple friends, actually, who have confided in me that his wife just said that part of our marriage is over. And obviously, through counseling, we would try to help and deal with that problem. It's a detailed, complicated. But did the Proverbs even talk about hard marriages? And so your spouse is not the ultimate answer. Some are widows or widowers. So that leads us to the third woman, which is Lady Wisdom. And this is in Proverbs 4, among other places. But in the book of Proverbs, you have the literal wife and the literal adulteress, and you have the figurative adulteress, which is representing all the folly. But the figurative, excellent wife is Wisdom herself. Wisdom personified. Chapter 9, you have Madam Folly and Lady Wisdom have banquets. Actually, Wisdom, then Folly. And you should choose the banquet of Lady Wisdom. And it's, and even if you're single, even if you're separated from your spouse, even if your marriage is really hard, Proverbs is saying that wisdom will always protect you. A wife may help you, but wisdom will always help you. In chapter 4, verse 5, acquire wisdom, acquire understanding. Not forget nor turn away from the words of my mouth. Do not forsake her. She will guard you. Love her. She will watch over you. The beginning of wisdom is acquire wisdom with your acquiring. Get understanding. Prize her. She will exalt you. She will honor you if you embrace her. She will place on your head a garland of grace. She will present you with a crown of beauty. And the language here is similar to the language of a wife. An excellent wife is the crown of her husband. So it's saying, you know, and again, it speaks of if marriage isn't everything, won't be everything, but if there's no marriage or it's a hard marriage, we can still turn to God's wisdom, and in there we can find joy and peace and satisfaction. And so there is hope. Next major section would be, okay, how do we make the sexual relationship in our marriage all that it should be? When I was in high school, many, many years ago, Josh McDowell used to come on high school campuses, public high school campuses, and it wouldn't be during class, but they would start advertising that he would give a talk called Maximum Sex. Of course, it was a hook to evangelize people. You know, we would talk about what the Bible says about that subject. But, you know, the way we get fullest enjoyment of God's gift is to pursue Him, to live out this gospel by which He has saved us in the context of our marriages. Some of this is review. I can go over it quickly. The first is to make your relationship with God your ultimate relationship, to find your greatest delight in Him. The simple truth is that if you're expecting your spouse to do for you what only God can do, you're going to be perpetually upset with them. That includes sex. Don't look to your spouse to meet needs only the Lord can meet. Tim Keller in his book talks about love economics, which is kind of like the tank in the love languages, that if you're full with the love of God, then you're going to be able to show grace to your spouse when they don't always meet every need you think you may have. So the first thing is to pursue that intimacy in relationship with Him. And the more you know of God's grace, the more gracious you will be. Part of that also is that is what will protect you from sexual temptation. Don't expect your spouse to be everything to you sexually, and therefore if they're not, you can give in to the temptation. It's your relationship with God, which is going to keep you safe more than your spouse. Your spouse is a secondary help, not the primary. And then apply everything we've already talked about since last night in your marriage. Wayne Mack gave the illustration that sexual problems in marriage are usually kind of like the red light on the dashboard of a car. If the red light is on, the problem is not with the light. There's a problem under the hood. And Paul Tripp writes, what diverts and destroys physical sexuality is a lack of love. And Keller talks about that too. It's like the passions of an affair burn themselves out over a short period of time. I've actually counseled in cases. I remember one of my early cases, meeting with a woman who had an affair with a guy at work and left her husband, married that guy. And after months with the new husband, she came to me, can I get my old husband back? You know, he seemed kind of dull, but she said, the passion I had with this guy I had the affair with, now I can't stand it. Something built merely on sexual passion is not going to last, even though initially it can be thrilling, as Proverbs warns. But it results in death and destruction. And so to have this commitment to your marriage, to give yourself to this other person, to know and understand what real love is, to, as the husband, to be the self-sacrificing, foot-washing leader, to treat his wife with respect, to take initiative in other areas, not just sexually. Oftentimes a wife will complain, talk to Caroline, say, it's hard for me to be excited about being physically with my husband when I feel like he's not interested in me for anything else the rest of the day. Now, it's not like here's a trick to get more sex if you just talk to your wife so maybe she'll be nicer to you. But it's from the heart, genuinely caring for her as Christ does you. And for the wife as well, to strive to be a helper, to be gracious, to work at resolving conflict, and to have real communication. Lovers must first be friends. Interestingly, in Song of Solomon, wife says, his mouth is full of sweetness and he is wholly desirable. This is my beloved and this is my friend. Friendship makes bodies come together in marriage. Keeping short accounts, pulling the weeds, avoiding temptation, all these things are talked about. And then Caroline, her notes from her talks for ladies are in the back. She's not going to be doing them separately. But I think she coined this, I don't know, but she had two talks called Graceless Sex and Grace Sex for Women. I've appropriated some of that into my notes, in that law sex says, I'm going to give my spouse what they have earned or what they deserve. And I've actually had counseling cases where right in front of me, the wife basically said, if you will do this thing I'm telling you to do, I'll have sex with you tonight. And it's this bargaining thing. Of course, often it's used for punishment. You've not met my expectations. And as bizarre as it may seem to some of you, we've seen more of a problem with husbands punishing with withdrawal of sex than wives. Man is angry and embittered with his wife. And I'm going to show I don't need you. I'm going to withhold this from you. And it's used as a weapon to hurt each other. And I want to put this in the context of ordinary marriages. If there is abuse, we've heard of cases of abuse where the wife is like almost forced to have sex in the wrong way, embarrassing way, inconvenient way, not taking care of it. There's all kinds of ways sex can be used horribly abusively. So I'm not talking about that, but I am saying sex is an area where we should be trying to outdo each other and caring for each other, not merely repaying what we earn. And this is where the Kellers in their book, I think, wrote profoundly. They said that early in their marriage, sex was kind of a challenge, and when they kind of focused on just making the other person happy and not a performance thing, it went a lot better, which is really what 1 Corinthians 7 says, that the husband must fulfill his duty to the wife and the wife to her husband. The husband does not have authority over his own body. The wife does, and vice versa for the wife. That to look at sex not as I'm going to get what I want because the culture says I'm supposed to have all these experiences, but this is a way, you know, to see it as God sees it. And God sees it as a good thing, but this is a way that I show my commitment to my spouse. This is the way I treat them better than they deserve. This is the way I show, again, not earned love, but gracious love. And it can be appreciation as well. That you're trying to outdo each other in grace. And again, you know, how do you figure this out? Well, the question you should be asking yourself is what is happening in this part of our marriage what my spouse desires? If not, how could I make it better? Now, in some cases, that might be I will accommodate to their desires being more or less than mine because I want them to be happy. And if you're both fighting for the other one's side, you'll probably be able to come to a good compromise as opposed to fighting for your own side. Deal graciously with what may be weaknesses of your spouse. Romans 15, you are strong, let it bear the weaknesses of those without strength and not just please ourselves. Each of us is to please his neighbor for his good, to his edification. I'm going to broad the application of what I think are some of the broad words that Paul's using in a particular context. Your spouse may have struggles here that you have to be patient with. One of the biggest problems, actually, a friend of mine wrote a book about help our marriage is impacted by sexual abuse in the past. And so, especially with women, and, you know, a large percentage of women have had something bad happen sexually. And as they come into marriage, they have a hard time, a difficult time entering in, to joyfully entering into what marriage should be sexually with their husband because of trauma, hurt, guilt. Sometimes it's guilt, where she was sinful prior to conversion or prior to marriage. Sometimes it's even guilt in this guy, where before they got married they were having sex. Now they're married and she feels guilty about that. So there can be emotional issues. Counseled in cases where women have physical issues, some of which can't. It's fine to go to a doctor and figure out what's going on. Sometimes the doctor can't figure it out, and maybe both emotional and physical. It's not always the honeymoon begins and never ends, and it's all perfectly easy and wonderful. Sometimes there is disappointment, which is why love is not, I love you because you're fulfilling me sexually, and to the extent you do that, I'm happy with you. Again, it's a gracious love. Be patient. Even, you know, as people get older, their bodies change and there are different levels of interest and accommodating ourselves to one another, even when there may be struggles, to say, well, might say, well, maybe my husband's a sexual idolater. He's so important. I don't think you've been appointed to punish him and knock that out of him by making him miserable. It can go too far, but it's showing you want to show grace. Again, focusing on bringing joy to your spouse. Sexuality has been given for the glory of God for them. The Kellers write, if your main purpose in sex is giving pleasure, not getting pleasure, then a person who does not have as much of a sex drive can give to the other person as a gift. Keller disagrees with those who would say if you were to have sex with your spouse just to please him or her, some say that would be inauthentic or even oppressive. They're saying, we can find joy, bringing joy sincerely to the spouse we love and who loves us, even if the kind of experience each one is having is different. Again, a lot of this, too, is kindling romance in the marriage, not just, I want to have sex. Watching out for staying up too late, being distracted, not planning time together. And then back to 1 Peter 3:7. This is something like, we know a lot about our own life. When we counsel, we learn what others are struggling with. And some of the stereotypes aren't always true. So you have to learn about your particular spouse. We've had women say, I got married thinking my husband would always want this, and he didn't seem that interested. We got to, is this something where he just doesn't have that much of a drive, and he's different in that way, but then he needs to learn how to take care of his wife? Or is he embittered about something? Is she guilty? Why is this? But we've had as many cases where the wife is disappointed that I was expecting this to be more important to him. But in other cases, the wife says, look, as long as he's happy, I'm happy. And so people are different. You need to understand your particular marriage and sort out the dynamics between this is weakness versus there may be sin issues or hurts from the past that need to be dealt with. I have a few questions in the back. I don't want to deal with them exhaustively. We're going to have a question and answer at the end. But these are the questions people tend to want to ask. How often should we have sex? I kind of already dealt with that. Paul says, don't deprive each other lest you be tempted. But he doesn't, it's kind of like the giving thing. It doesn't say what the percentage you should give, save, and spend. And, the question would be, is this something where my spouse is joyful and content? Does my spouse feel well-loved by me in this area? And again, sometimes the most loving thing you can do is let them rest and sleep. Sometimes it's to pursue when you're tired. So I want to make sure they are satisfied. And sometimes you may need help from godly older people to sort some of that out. It's never appropriate to force. 1 Corinthians 7, this is we talked with the men about toxic masculinity. Some of that relates to abuse. 1 Corinthians 7 does not mean that one spouse has the right at any time to demand sex from the other person, whether they want to or not. It's meant to be something mutually agreeable, loving. This is where some men have been guilty of saying, well, I'm in charge, so I get whatever I want. Part of the sadness of that is, what we really want is somebody who loves us and wants to be with us, not somebody who's going to try to placate us just to keep us from being angry. What should I do if my spouse is in this? I think the Kellers had some good some answers for that. Are there issues that need to be addressed? Are there issues of noise, of hygiene, children around, or some people have just never had a healthy view of what this is and they need to rethink. We've been growing up in Corinth and we need to learn to rethink these things in a more biblical way. The birth control question, my understanding, which I think would be pretty conventional, is that we are free to limit the number of children we have. I think we ought to want to have children ordinarily, but I don't think we're required to have as many as possible. But we're not allowed to use a birth control method that could potentially kill an unborn child, which generally means the Lord has made it kind of difficult to prevent having children. You're free to try as long as you don't do something dangerous. A question that comes up a lot is, what if a couple can't agree on how many children to have? And I think, again, we need to talk those things through. We need sometimes to get godly counsel. I do think husbands need to be listening very carefully to the desires of their wife, because having those children means something to those women. Whatever Paul means in 1 Timothy 2, when he says women will be saved through bearing children, not that they would be soteriologically because they have kids, probably. I think the most likely meaning is they're not allowed to teach or exercise authority, but boy, here's something they can do. We can, and it's really, really important. Regardless of that, it's a big part of their life that we need to be sensitive. They may feel differently than we do. What about taking permanent measures to stop having kids? We actually spent a long time meeting with a couple recently where they've had two children, and the wife feels very strongly two and no more, and the husband would like to keep the option open of having more. And we tried to help them to understand, I can't tell you what to do. I can tell you that given that your sexuality belongs to your spouse and vice versa, I think it would be good not to take any drastic measures until you're both agreed. You're still pretty young. And what you decide today may not be what you think in 3 or 4 years. And so I can't compel you. I had a friend who, we had a couple we knew where after the birth of the second baby, the wife almost died. She was discovered to have a very serious heart condition, and they said if she gets pregnant again and goes through the pregnancy, this likely could kill her. And likewise, for her to have surgery for herself not to have more children would have been a strain on her. So the husband got a vasectomy, which I regarded as an application of Ephesians 5:25. He made a sacrifice for her health and her safety, and I think in that situation, I admire what he did. Some people wonder, well, what does it mean when Paul says, stop depriving one another, except by agreement for a time, so you may devote yourselves to prayer and then come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So this idea of a temporary abstinence for the sake of prayer, the answer is, I'm not really sure what it means. apparently he's describing there may be, but he said not too long, whatever that means. There's been a lot when sex books are written by Christians, usually people go to the chapters about, well, what are you allowed to do together sexually? Back to the point, I should want to do sexually that which pleases my spouse and nothing that would make them feel uncomfortable or awkward. And, you know, in the case where the wife calls in the middle of the night and says, my husband is asking for this, you know, I met with the guy saying, where did you get these ideas? I'm pretty sure I know where you got these ideas. God has given you a loving wife who is happy to come together with you in the ordinary way. And the problem here is for you to be content with that, not to push the other person to do something that for them is unpleasant. It's meant to be wonderful for them, not something where they're doing something miserable just to placate you. Another question that often comes up is Viagra or ED drugs. And again, part of it is motive. We've had a case of a man who would be 40-ish, and he's had problems getting that to work, and his wife is extremely upset about it. And this man is a procrastinator. And so for a couple of years, they had virtually no intimacy. It wasn't working. She was extremely frustrated. She was responding in sinful ways. And our advice, when we got involved, was if this will help you fulfill what 1 Corinthians 7 says, and that's something your wife wants, it sounds like that could be a legitimate means at the present time for you to be able to function, not for yourself to just be crazy happy, but to bring happiness to your wife who feels sad. And he finally did that, and it helped, and that was probably a good use of that medication. We've also had a case where an older man got hold of the stuff, and his wife kind of complained, like, this is too much. Which, again, he wasn't doing that to fulfill his duty to her. It became perhaps an expression of his own idolatry. The last thing I'll mention about will be regarding children. I think when you see Proverbs, one thing that's happening is sex education is happening primarily in the home. It's a father giving his children wisdom about how to recognize the wrong kind of woman, how to choose the right kind of woman, that sex can be extremely tempting, and here's how you need to recognize it and run from it, put on your glasses. Here's how great things can be in marriage. And so I think it's good for us. By the way, in our culture, our children are getting an immense amount of bad information about sex. And we had a friend who said, you know, if you go out to the Walmart and your kids are with you, they're going to learn all kinds of bad things about sex, no matter how sheltered you try to be. And so we want them to see it as God sees it, to prepare them for their own marriages, to protect them from temptation. And one of the best things you can do is to have a marriage where they can see. I mean, the world is saying the greatest sexual experience is if you're a teenager with your boyfriend or girlfriend in high school, and it's going to be so amazing, which is all a lie anyway. But the greatest experience should be you're married, you're committed, you love each other, and Caroline likes to joke that we're kind of magnetized. So, you know, we hug in the house sometimes, and, you know, our kids would walk in and we're hugging, oh, Mom, Dad, you know, but it's still conveying a message that they should believe that the best possible experience of sex is to be for a lifetime with the person to whom you're married. And this is a story I have permission for, that when our kids would have probably been all teenagers, when you're at Christmas, we're opening gifts, and the last gift, Caroline gives me this little box. And inside the box are two items. There's a card offering me a weekend away, just the two of us. And if the implication of the card is not clear enough, then there's a little nightie for her to wear on this vacation of ours. It was red, and that was the color my face turned. And my kids are, oh, you know, just... There we were, the old people, wanting to get away alone away from the kids. I'll mention one last thing that's more serious, though. I think we also need to warn our kids about how evil the world is right now. In Deuteronomy, it talks about the duty to cry out. Someone approaches a young woman, it could be a young man. Because the culture is so wicked, and there's a book by the Holcombs called God Made All of Me, but I think it's really important to teach our children to warn them. If someone tries to touch you, use you, talk to you, keep secrets with you, I wish we didn't need that so much in our culture, but we do need that in our families. And so there's both the right side, mommy and daddy love each other, but that's for marriage, and to your children may encounter this. As I grew up, had two cases of men who tried to lure me into sexual relationships when I was a teenager growing up in Austin, Texas at the time. And I'm so thankful God delivered me from being pulled into that. But now that once I've studied how they do that, they were using those tricks on me. If you tell anybody what I'm into, so it's out there, and we need to be careful. So, in summary, this is also for those who are single too, that while sex is a good thing within marriage, sex is not going to be forever. When Jesus says in heaven, we will neither marry nor be given in marriage, Jesus, the ultimate man, was not sexual with a human being, and not sexual in his humanity, and when he told us that this is, well, read it to get it right, John 17:3. The world says sex is the ultimate experience in life. But Jesus tells us, this is eternal life, they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ whom you have sent. That is the very best thing. When that's the best thing, we can enjoy the lesser things, but we keep them in their place. Amen.